Let's talk a little bit about vibration absorbers then. We kind of talked, introduced at a high, kind of intuitive level how they might work. Let's look at some of the math. Okay, so I kind of catch us up, maybe. Section 4.4. And we had a system that was a main mass, M1. And it's connected to the ground by K1. We're doing this without damping to start out with. And there's some applied force. I'm going to draw it off to the side. F. Okay. And displacement of that guy is X1. And then what we're saying is, hey, we're trying to figure out, can I add some kind of little auxiliary system? It's a mass, M2, and spring, K2. Such that if I have a pure harmonic in F, that X1 actually has low amount of vibration. Effectively, what we're saying, all the energy from F pushing on this thing gets pushed into the M2 subsystem. Right. And we wrote out some equations of motion. Those are in the notes, and we did it last time. Like this. Okay. Where we have our inertia matrix M, capital M, stiffness matrix K, kind of input matrix F. Equation like that. Okay. Like I said, for a given kind of pure harmonic in F, right? If I want to know the response of this guy, I can write this equation like that. I can assume some pure harmonic, and that means to get the response X. I need to take the matrix inverse of the K minus omega squared, where in this case, that omega is the omega of the input itself. That's your input frequency. Okay. When I do that matrix inversion, which we talked through last time, let me write up the terms. I get those two expressions to describe the magnitude of the x1 motion and magnitude of the x2 motion. And that's kind of the two components of this vector solution, the two rows of that vector solution, what that returns. Okay, that delta omega is what? A characteristic polynomial. That's the determinant of this matrix. So we looked at this, and kind of what we were saying is, can I add this system K2, M2? And then if I'm able to add that, how do I need to pick, or what can I pick any K2 and M2 such that X1 is near zero? Or in theory, equal to zero. Looking at this, can we do that? What do I need to happen for x1 to be 0? Well, I need the, I think you're talking about, I need the numerator of this expression to be 0. Right? So I need if I don't want x1 to move, I want the numerator of that magnitude expression to be 0. Okay. Well, f bar in general is not going to be 0. It could be, but then it's just not moving. It doesn't matter. Right. So if f bar is not 0, I really need that to be true. Right. So that tells me how to pick K2 and M2. So I need to pick something like, you know, it looks something like the natural frequency if this was just an isolated system. Right? So I can pick K2 and M2 to match their square root, to match whatever frequency that I want low vibration at. And if I do that, if I do it perfectly, that term goes to 0 and X1 never moves, no matter what I do to F. How's that possible? Perfectly out of phase. Yeah.
Does that have something to do with it being smaller in the path of least resistance?
Not necessarily. Yeah. So if I'm okay, let's think about this a different way. If M1 is stationary, what did Mr. Newton tell us about the forces acting on it? Yeah, they had net forces acting on that guy to be 0 for all time. Okay. So let's look at the forces acting on M1. What forces do we have? Well, I have the applied force. I have the K1 spring force. What else do I have? I've got a K2 spring force. Match the way I draw that in notes. Yep, that's the way I drew it. And that guy is also acting on M2, right? Equal and opposite. Okay. So what we need, so if we're thinking about this, if this guy is perfectly stationary, well, let's back up. What's that first spring force? K1x1. Okay. So this guy is perfectly stationary. What is that force? Zero. X1 is zero. It's not moving. So if it's if we're assuming, so let's assume it's stationary. What has to happen? We assume it's stationary. That K1 force just goes away because it's not moving. That spring's not being deflected at all. So that leaves us that, hey, those guys better be balancing exactly for all time if X1's going to stay exactly stationary for all time. Okay, does that happen? I don't know. Let's see. Okay. So if we look at this, how do we get to that? Well, we know delta 2, right, is K2 F bar. And if we look at that characteristic polynomial, we end up, let me see, let's hold on to that for a second. Okay, so let's just look at some frequency. Let's pick and say we want to excite this system at the natural frequency of that first original subsystem, K1M1 subsystem. Okay. And we're going to want low vibration there. From what we saw over here, we want this to match the frequency of my excitation, which, as we're saying, let that be the natural frequency, the first thing. Okay. So if I do that, I can look at that delta omega, that characteristic polynomial, and it is... that, and then minus k. Equal to that. Yeah. And I just took, that's just the determinant of this guy. All right, so if I do that, let's look. So if I have k1 plus k2, I look at omega squared, let's plug in the k1 m1 term for that. It's square root, so we square it, m1. And let's plug in the, that expression. Those are all equal, so we can plug whatever version we want in, right? Okay, so what do we have going on? We end up with, those guys cancel. Then we have K1 minus K1. They go away, right? These guys cancel. So we end up with an expression here. Zero. Yep. So this guy goes to zero at K2 minus K2. He's zero. So all we have is that. So our delta omega... that in this case, right? Or, yeah. Okay. So if you look back over here, when we evaluate that characteristic polynomial at this frequency, get that, right? And at this frequency, we get minus f bar over k2. Okay, that's kind of interesting. If we look at just this frequency, what's the force of that spring? Spring 2. And you can simplify it. We're assuming that M1 is fixed. So what is it? Yeah, K2X2. Okay. So the force from that spring... it's just that, right? Okay. So if I look at the magnitude of that, if we evaluate everything at the frequency which we designed the vibration absorber, right, I get the force of the spring k2, and of course you'd have some time terms here. Which we don't need to worry about really for right now. So you'd have sine omega t or whatever your input was, right? But look at that force of the spring. It's exactly opposite of my input force. So the math checks out. And we're able to pick a k2 and m2 such that m1 can stay stationary. It's a pretty cool idea. So we use this, you've seen it on the bridge video I showed you guys, first day of class. That big hanging pendulum inside the skyscraper in Taipei, Taipei 101, that is this, effectively. It's just a pendulum instead of a mass and a spring. Right? So you hear it in building design, you hear this idea called a tuned mass damper. Right? You'll see outside of the building design domain, it's called a vibration absorber. Kind of late 90s, early 2000 Japanese cars had these things all over them. One reason they sounded kind of quiet. So any kind of vibration got passed off these little masses that are vibrating all over the place rather than the door rattling or whatever. Yeah. You see these a lot on rotating machinery. Right, so you have rotating imbalance problem from chapter 2, right? Right. That imbalance, you know the frequency you have to spin the thing at. You can put a vibration absorber on that. It takes all that rotating imbalance energy, and it's sitting there vibrating away rather than vibrating your floor or your workpiece or whatever you're working on. You also see these on power lines. Okay. You guys know, like, there's a power line coming up to a tower. There's like this little thing here. You guys seen those on kind of high voltage power lines? It's called a Stockbridge damper, named after the guy that developed it. It's a vibration absorber for oscillation in the electrical line. So this guy wants to move when the wind's blowing on it. All that energy gets passed off this little mass spring damper system, basically, rather than the electrical line bouncing around. So this is something to understand. These are really useful. They get used a lot. Okay. Let's look at what the frequency response of this thing might look like. Okay, so we have kind of this idea works in theory. Okay, let's look at the kind of theoretical frequency response. And then I guess next week we're probably going to not have time to do it today. We'll look at kind of an actual, how does this work in practice? And we'll see that we need to make some additions to make it actually work in practice. So let's start out we'll just concentrate on magnitude for right now. So I'm going to label that response magnitude because we're going to plot x1 and x2 on there. So and then we're going to look at input frequency omega on that forcing function. Okay. So without that without the vibration absorber, what happens to the system? One degree of freedom, so what happens? Goes up. We just did that a few minutes ago, right? Goes up to infinity, some constant. Something like that. That's without the vibration absorber. This original mass spring system, M1, K1. So what we said, and let's look at the case where we're matching the natural frequency. Our input frequency matches the natural frequency. Right? So we designed this vibration absorber so that we want zero here. Okay. And we said, hey, that can work. We just showed that works. Let's assume we got it there. Okay. What happens to this guy out at high X1 out at high frequency of F, you think? Or somebody say, I think. Doesn't vibrate. Goes to zero. Like, we've already looked at this system, basically, with just it on its side and one more spring. Right? So, yeah, we're still going to go out to zero out here. What happens at low frequency? Yeah, it still goes to some constant. You still basically have just some kind of static deflection there. Okay. So we've got those two pieces figured out. How many natural frequencies do I have now? Two. Why two? I have 2 degrees of freedom now, once I've added that second mass. Okay. So now I don't have just one place, I have two. And it might be something like that. So what do you think happens as I approach that first natural frequency? To the amplitude of x1. x1 with the absorber. But still don't have any damping, so what happens? Yeah, it blows up. Okay. What happens to X1 as I approach that second natural frequency? It's going to blow up again. Happens at high frequency. Got that one figured out already. Okay. And we got this point. So what happens? With the absorber, the frequency response of X1 looks like that. Where this guy is what we designed a vibration absorber for, where that guy is zero. In this case, we just happened to pick the natural frequency of that first system. What's going on with X2 this whole time? So X2 only exists in the second case, right? So we have two modes, right? So we know it's going to blow up at both of those natural frequencies. So X2 is also going off to infinity in both these places. What do you think happens to X2 at high frequency? Going to go to zero. Happens X2 at low frequency. Go to some constant. In this case, it's not guaranteed to be the same. Depends on the masses and springs and how they're set up. Right. So it could be higher, it could be lower. Not necessarily the same. What happens to X2 in between those two frequencies? Right. So we figured out for all frequencies less than the first natural frequency, first mode, we figured out for what happens for all frequencies above the second mode. What's going on in between? What has to be happening? Has to be moving. Why? X1 isn't. It has to. M2 has to be moving in some way to balance out F. Right? So we can say, well, you know, some approximation. Has to have some non-zero amplitude in between. Okay. We talked through this a little bit last time. Let's run through it again real quick. Okay. I get to pick, right? What matters is that ratio. I want that to be equal to the square of whatever frequency I want to try to suppress motion of X1 at. So that means I could have a big K2 and a big M2 for the same value, right? I could have a small K2 and a small M2. I could scale them up and down. As long as I scale them proportionally, this is still going to work. Okay. So what's the trade-off there? Well, one, for the system in general, is, yeah, I have these two modes made it now to worry about. Which in some cases, could be troublesome. Okay, but in terms of picking K2 and M2, if I have stiffness versus weight, okay, so let's start with the heavy case. I pick a really big M2. What does that mean for K2? It's got to be really stiff. What does that mean for how much X2 is moving? Not much, actually. Right, so it doesn't have to move as much to generate the same force, same magnitude of force. Okay? So if you look at this plot for a big M2 and then therefore big K2, right, you get this green line comes down also. Okay? What also happens if you work out the math, and there's pictures in the notes, is that actually with a big K2 and M2, these frequencies also spread out. And what that does for you is this point where it's actually zero becomes not so sharp anymore. So yeah, there's still only one point where it's exactly zero, but there's some range where it's almost zero. Okay? So that kind of pushes you towards, I want to use as big a vibration absorber as I can get away with, because I'm never going to get it exactly right. So I want to consider the case. I'm never, almost never going to get exactly right. There's going to be some error. Right? So I want to pick a range where I can have a range of low vibration, bigger range of where the vibration is actually low. If I pick a small M2, I have a smaller physical size, smaller mass added to the system, right? Because I need a small K2. What does that mean for the amplitude that X2 has to move over? Somebody said it. It's got to be higher, right? Because I need to move X2 more for KX2 to equal the same magnitude of F. So X2 goes up. So X2 has to move a lot more. You need more space for that vibration absorber to work. What also happens is that these start coming back together. And I end up with a really sharp peak around that place where it's exactly zero. So the smaller case is also much less robust to you getting the frequency you designed it for wrong. So that's the fundamental trade-off in designing these vibration absorbers. Right? Between kind of size and robustness and magnitude of motion. Questions?
What effect does it have on the vibrations you don't want, like the frequency, other than the one you want? Like, how could you describe that? Like, does it add unwanted vibration at the lower frequency?
Well, yeah, I mean, you see, like, for the undamped case here, right? In an undamped case, my system was kind of blowing up at one frequency. Now I got two frequencies that it blows up at. Right? So depending on what your system needs to do, that could cause a lot more trouble. Right? So it's one of those answers, yeah, it kind of depends whether it's going to actually help you or not. Right? But generally, when you're going to do this, you're looking at, I want this one frequency. Right? I have to operate around this place. I know it's troublesome. You know, for my original system. Remember, this force doesn't have to be us actually actively doing that on purpose, right? This is the ground, this is the earthquake in the building example. I have no control over what that frequency is. But I can design that vibration absorber so that the frequency range that's the most troublesome for the structure gets filtered out by the absorber, no matter what the input frequency is. Other questions? That's a good place to stop. See you guys next week.